Morning, members. Members, we're at that stage where we're starting to shift over into hearing bills as the regular course of the day. And so today we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 bills lined up for your consideration. And before I start, let me just say we did get a card for a colleague, Representative Benson. And so I'll pass that around, and feel free to sign on, and we'll be sure to get that off to John as soon as possible. I'll just pass it this way. And then I suppose we should do adoption of the minutes. So I'll entertain a motion for the February 4th minutes, which are in your package, members. So if Senator Faust moves approval of the February 4th minutes, any discussion, members? If not, then all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. First bill up this morning is Representative Nornes, House File 322. Representative Nornes. Good morning, Representative Nornes.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Mariani and the members. We have planned for a brief presentation today that still hopefully will move on to government operations. And would you like me to make a motion?
Yes, that would be appropriate, Representative.
I move House File 322 to pass and move on to the Government Operations Committee. Members, this bill does basically one thing. It increases from 15% to 30% the percentage of qualified voters in the district who must sign a petition to place a question before voters on revoking or reducing an operating referendum. And this issue comes as a result of a referendum that passed in the school district, the Burgess Frazee School District, which is up in my area, and also Representative Murdoch's area and Representative Eakin's area. It kind of borders all three of our districts. We have the superintendent of the Frazee Burgess School District with us today, Darren Fender, and he can give you kind of a brief overview of what has led us up to this point.
Terrific. Good morning, Superintendent Fender. It's good to have you here. I hope the drive down this morning or last night wasn't terribly cold for you, but it's good to have you here.
Good morning, and thank you. It was a change in climate coming from up north. It was unusual to see people walking to work instead of commuting through the vehicle.
There is a handout, I believe, too, that all of you should have.
Members, you're finding the handout, hopefully, in your packet. Very good. Superintendent, we'll need to have you state your name for the record.
My name is Darren Fender, Superintendent of the Frazee Burgess School District. And I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be here today to present on House File 322, authored by Representative Nornes. The Frazee Burgess School District, and this is an issue that not is only is familiar for the Frazee Burgess School District because we're experiencing it, but it is an issue that the 313 school districts in the state of Minnesota that currently have a referendum on referendum authority face the potential of losing or reducing their referendum ability to generate revenue. Our school district did not have an existing referendum. After 7 years and 5 attempts, we were successful in passing a $1,000 per pupil unit referendum on November 6th of 2007. On July 30th of 2008, the district a petition was filed on the school board clerk with about 860 signatures. Enough of those signatures were verified to be qualified to put a question on the November ballot to revoke the full authority of the referendum that was passed 1 year earlier. The petition rights state that 15% of eligible voters, 15% of voters without even being registered can sign a petition to revoke or reduce the authority of a school district's referendum. Now in that handout I've included some information. And there's from the desk of the superintendent, this is what I sent out to my staff the day that the petition was filed on the school district. Wanted to make sure that they had enough information to know what was happening to our school district. Can the referendum be revoked or reduced? Yes, it can. There's a process in place which is being addressed today in House File 322 where we're recommending that the change be made from 15% of voters to 15% of registered voters, or not 15% of registered voters, 30% of registered voters. Simply just qualifying it as registered voters increases the expectations of the citizens in their attempt to remove a referendum. The other questions I posed to our staff was, is this an organized group out there working to revoke or reduce the referendum? Yes. And I think in many school districts across the state of Minnesota, we are faced with opposition. Even in good economic times, we're faced with opposition. These are all in the circumstances that we currently face. And I think the problem is, the reason why people are really unaware of this potential to revoke or reduce referendum is that they are not aware they can revoke or reduce referendum. If it happens in Frazee, we will not be the first school district to lose our referendum authority and face financial difficulties. It will be a widespread action that will move swiftly across the state due to our difficult economic times. And even when you're not experiencing economic difficulties, you always run into the people who are dissatisfied with the decisions that a school board has taken or administration has taken or a teacher. There's plenty of issues that they can generate. Consider this for yourself. In your legislative districts, if 15% of your voters could petition to put a ballot back on the question for you to seek re-election 1 year after you've been elected, what difficulties and challenges would you face as a legislator? We are experiencing those difficulties and challenges in our school district. We don't know how to plan. We do the best we can. We don't know how to move forward, not knowing what's going to happen next year. And I can assure you that in the summer of 2009, these petitioners will not make the same mistake twice. I can assure you that they will have a petition filed in our office probably before June with the required number of signatures underneath current statutes to revoke our full authority. And I can almost assure you, if it goes to vote in November of 2009, our referendum will be revoked. And I can almost assure you that while we would be the first, we will not be the last. And in 2010, you're going to see a massive, this is my prediction, you're going to see a lot of school districts that have been struggling to pass referendums lose their referendum authority or have reduced referendum authority. And there's extreme implications that come with that to the quality of education. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Let's go, Dorian.
I guess that pretty well covers the need that we're trying to portray. And if there's any questions, we take a question or two.
Thank you, Representative Norris. And so, let's just be real clear: the change is on page 3. The change is moving from 15% of registered voters to 30%. It's technically a very simple bill, although
it
obviously
the bar.
Yeah,
very great.
Right. Okay.
Now, the one thing that I'd ask the superintendent to point out, this is not, I mean, it is initiated by the Frazee-Virgus School District, but it has strong support from other districts and the School Board Association and others, and maybe he can just quickly highlight that for us.
It is supported by the School Board Association, the Minnesota Association for School Administrators, the MREA, and I believe Parents United is probably an endorser of this bill.
Very well, thank you. We have several questions. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure, by reading this, I believe that I understand this correct, but this only affects referendums that have been voted on by the district. It wouldn't affect school boards. Any other levies that the school board puts on that could be repealed, only the ones previously voted on. Is that correct? And for how long after that vote can it be done? At any time that it's still in effect?
Two questions, then. Superintendent Sender.
That is correct. It doesn't affect school board elections. It doesn't affect bond issues. This is referendum authority for levies. And the second question is, could you restate the second question?
I apologize.
Yeah, no problem. If the referendum is for 7 years, they can do it at any time in those 7 years or only within the first year, or is there a time
limit? They can do it any time within those 7 years. The law states, the statute states that they, once they have an attempt, and it doesn't mean like in this case where they filed a petition, they weren't successful, or the board rejected it because it didn't meet the criteria of the statement. If they come back this year and it meets, they meet all the criteria, and it goes to vote, it has to go to vote once in any time period, and that's the only opportunity they have. Once it's gone to vote, it cannot be brought back up. So if the districts and our residents of our district voted it down in support of the district and to keep the referendum authority, it can't come back up for the remainder of that term.
And on that point, Sonornis, is that that particular question is not in question in this bill. That's the current law, I think. Very well. Representative Boyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, I'm looking at the vote margin. It was 61.13% of your citizens voted yes. I'm just curious about the 30% needed to now invoke a new election for that. Is it your sense that 30% would be very difficult for the minority of the citizens to achieve? How did you arrive at that number?
Superintendent Senator, or Representative.
Actually,
go ahead.
Superintendent proposed the 40% threshold. And in our discussion,
if I can address that too,
Representative Norton.
It was as the bill was being drafted, I thought maybe as a compromise, not to go to that 40 limit and at least be a little reasonable and stay at 30, still doubles the amount or number. But I basically picked that number for really no other reason other than I was just trying to be a little less.
The members, I don't want to discourage questions about the mechanics of the elections, the thresholds, parameters. However, this bill will be, if it's successful here, will be moving on to three committees. I'm counting GovOps as the motion before us. Taxes would be the other committee, and then I believe K-12 Finance also wants to look at this bill as well. And then, of course, there's, you know, the exit committees, finance, or ways and means as well. And again, I'm not trying to stifle. I think it's appropriate for you to ask questions you do. But our opportunity as the K-12 Policy Committee is to also be able to vet out what, if any, implications this has in terms of implementing effective K-12 policy in this or any other district. Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The proposal to do this doesn't just affect the authority for voters to bring up revoking levies, right? It also would impact the ability for voters to come to their school board and say we want to increase our levies. Is that right?
Superintendent Spender.
That is correct. This 126C, which is a statute that addresses petitioning, also addresses the petition that would come to a school board to seek a referendum. So the change in this statute would also change the statute requirements for voters to come to a school board to serve a petition on them, asking them to place the question on the ballot. Keep in mind that when the voters, when they seek to revoke or reduce the referendum and they have enough signatures and they meet all the criteria, legal requirements, the school board has no choice but to put that question on the ballot.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. I want you to understand, I empathize with the difficulty of trying to get school referendums passed in difficult areas, but the question I have, I guess, for you is there's nothing that prevents you from putting a competing, from preventing the school board from putting a competing ballot question on that same ballot at the same time, or from another school group putting a new, you know, coming to the school board with its petition of 15 or 30% of the voters and saying, you know, we want more money for the school. So the voters could be deciding it on that same ballot. Is that correct?
Superintendent Spender.
So I'm understanding your question correctly. it would be a situation where there could be a question that reduces or revokes the referendum, and at the same time a question to the citizens asking them to increase it. I think there's a possibility that that could happen. I think that creates a lot of challenges in terms of clarity and communication. Right now, you know, after I've ran 7 referendums in my career, and it's difficult to get people to understand the current language of a referendum. The more language you put on that ballot, the more challenges you have in getting people to understand what it really is that they're voting on. But I believe you are correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My question has already been answered.
Representative Demmer.
I think, Mr. Chair, a couple of questions, and Ms. Larson may get involved in this, so I'll give you a heads up. Do we know statistically how long, when referendums are passed, how long are they typically set up for? I think the maximum we can do is 10 years. Am I correct about that?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, you may want to ask the
You know, and I see the School Board Association nearing close by, and so why don't we do have a couple of other questions, but perhaps we can have some quick testimony on that in regards to your question, and then also hear their ideas here as well.
Mr. Chair, if I could,
my
thinking is that, you know, school districts, we need to be thinking about school districts, when this is passed, they make a plan for a period of time.
Sure.
And I think in 1 year the petition bring us up. The other question I have is for the superintendent. Do the people who brought the petition, did they come before the school board at all and talk about their concerns, or did they simply file it at the clerk's office and then you presented it at the school board? I mean, was there ever any kind of communication with the people who were organizing and putting this on?
Superintendent Spender, I see your smile.
There's been discussions for 7 years. In the 7 years of our struggle to pass a referendum, in the 5 attempts, there's been numerous discussions. The group that filed the petition has been our organized no vote group for the last 4 years. And so there's been several discussions. There's districts held several forums, community forums, trying to get communication and information. I want to be clear, this really wasn't an issue of just about taxes in my district. However, that issue is now surfacing, and it's an issue that they can use with our current economic situation to generate support. When they were out circulating the petition, I received numerous phone calls within the month that they were doing it, with a lot of accusations of false information being circulated. You know, did you like the action of this teacher? No. Well, don't you want to know where they spend their money? It really signed in something to call for an audit. There was a lot of deception that went that took place through this process. But the group is a very small group. They're very organized. They're very educated. And they're actually extremely powerful. And we do know they're there, and we have reached out to them in attempts to work with them. I'm sorry to say, but I think the only answer they want is there will not be a referendum in Frazee. And what they would like to see is the Frazee Burgess School District closed down and be dissolved in between the Perm and Detroit Lakes. And that is not the mission of our school board or our administration or our community.
Mr. Dean, welcome to the committee. And I think you all have some other ideas to share as well. But if you can also address Representative Demmer's question, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Dean. I'm legal counsel for the School Board Association. I'll just speak to Representative Demmer's question.
Thank you.
Give you a little historical context. At one time, there was no limitation on the length that referendums could go. If they were approved, they could be forever. The legislature came back and put a 10-year limit on. I can't give you a statistical piece here as to how many. Lots of them are for 10, maybe half or more are for when they go out, they go for the 10 years. But districts tailor these to the political context of their own district. There's lots of districts that'll run them for 5. There's some that'll run them for 8. And especially if they have multiple ones that are out there, sometimes they're trying to coordinate them so that they all come together so they're not having to go to election every year. You know, you only have the one election within every decade or so on renewing what you have.
Thank you, Representative Demers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just got a note from Mr. Strom, and he said the maximum is 10. That's the legal maximum. He thought the average is about 8. And last year there were 66 referendums, and 34 of them were for 10 years. And that's the status statistics I was looking for. My comment regarding that is the concern I have is that, you know, on the one hand we have the right of people to petition and do that sort of thing, and I think it's an important thing that we have in our society. On the other side of the coin is there's the business of running it and the time frame that you set up, and that you, once you pass this, you set up your budgets going forward, and in 1 year to be able to revoke that really is it's a curveball, a big time curveball, I think, for the school district. I think the bar should also be high. So it's as we discuss this, I think we all have to be thinking about that in terms of support or not, is my concern.
And Representative Demmer, given the what we're hearing from school districts in terms of the increasing dependency on operating referendums relative to a generation ago, perhaps the landscape and the psychology and the odds, what's at stake has also changed, perhaps relative to original drafting of legislation.
I know we've probably gone beyond our time here, but I just wanted to point out one thing. I believe Superintendent Sender has been in Frazee for 7 years?
4 years.
4 years?
4 years.
Okay. Well, every year he's been there, they've been dealing with this issue. And finally it passed, finally to get some, we should say, some traction and can do some positive things. So that's the reason he's here, because they need to move on, hopefully, to provide a good education for those students. And I think they're doing it.
Thank you.
I'd like to renew my motion unless there are other questions.
We do have a couple other questions, and we have another individual that wants to testify. We had thought we'd move this quickly, but, you know, like most things up here in legislature, nothing ever goes the way you had planned and thought, but that's okay. It's important, members, that we fully understand our actions and that we carefully vet out, you know, proposals before. So we have a question for Representative Brainerd, and then I'll have Mr. Scott Kroonquist kind of circulate near the testimony box so that you can go next. Representative Brainerd.
Mr. Chair, this is just a quick comment that was instigated by Representative Obermueller's question. And yeah. I would say that a higher threshold is definitely appropriate for a petition to withdraw a referendum simply because of the investment that a community makes in the original election process. Every opportunity is there for the opposition at that time to appropriately make their case to the public, and I support the higher threshold.
Thank you, Representative Reiner. Mr. Kroonquist, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And we would just like to go on record strongly in support of this initiative. We thank Representative Norris and Superintendent Sender for bringing this forward. Don't really need to add a lot, the reasons you've heard, but school districts now, some school districts depend on operating referenda revenue for over 20% of their general fund budget. And, you know, the way it is, we put that money at risk periodically when the referendum is up for renewal. And the amount of work that goes into these referendum campaigns is incredible. It dominates the staff, the administrative, the parent time when they're trying to renew these things. And to have a situation where a small minority, really, in the community could force a school district to go through that whole process again, you know, a year later, is really a travesty. So we think, if anything, this 30% is too low and it should be even higher. But we want to go on record in support of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kukas. And members, I think it's at least it's the opinion of this chair that I think it's important that whatever we do relative to citizens' abilities, whether they're supportive or not, that we acknowledge and recognize the right, the absolute right of our citizens to be able to petition and to act on either initiating or revoking referendums. That's just part of our landscape as in terms of our democracy. But at the same time, members, we also want to make sure that in doing that, that we have fair processes. And I would hope that members of this legislature aren't predisposed to create unfair conditions that would either weigh predetermine the outcome of these elections through technical processes ahead of time. I think it's really important for us to strike that balance. I suspect we all share that sentiment. With that, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against? If not, then Representative Nornes renews his motion that House File 322 be recommended to pass and referred to the Government Operations Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nornes. Thank you, Superintendent, and safe driving back.
Thank you.
Members, our next bill is House File 320. Representative Zettmer. Thank you. Representative Zettmer, welcome to the committee. We kept the seat open for you here, and I keep looking for you, and I don't see you, so we miss you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. But really, I don't miss the 8:30 meeting as much.
Don't rub it in. You might lose on your vote.
That's true. But I come before you today at the request of, I know my school district, my couple of board members called me, and also administration. And last year we passed a bill mandating background checks on people coming into our schools, especially the volunteers. I was a co-author. Representative Bingham was the author of that bill. We also went through a conference committee, and we thought we had all the everything ironed out, but it came forth to me that according to my school district, if they wanted to bring in a volunteer, that they would not be allowed to pay for their background check on volunteers, according to the current statute. So basically, all my bill does is just to clean up the language, and the key word is may. School districts may pay for background checks on people that they bring in an interview, or people that are in as volunteers. So if you would look on lines 118, 227, and 34, the key word, a school district hiring, a school hiring authority may decide to pay for the cost of conducting background checks under this paragraph, in which case the individual who is subject to the background check need not pay for the background check. The key word is may. The district does not have to, but they may pay for the background checks. And I know there might be a concern, well, what about people that are coming in to as a full-time teacher or a coach that are hired and paid. Again, the school district may pay for that, but these people are not part of the bargaining unit. I mean, they don't have a right to say, you will pay for my background check. It's not part of the contract. But all that the language does is that they may pay for background checks. And the key thing here is the volunteers that come into the schools, if they're going to be performing these volunteer, that many schools have a lot of volunteers coming in, that the school district would like to be able to have the option to pay for those background checks. And I'm open for any questions.
Representative Zettmer, let's get your bill properly in front of the committee for action. The chair moves that House File 320 be recommended to pass forwarded to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be forwarded to the K-12 Finance Committee. So motion before us, are there any questions from members at this point? Representative Faust and then Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Approximately how much is the cost of one of these background checks? Are we talking $20 or $200 or how much?
Chair and Representative Faust, I think it's $19.95, if I am correct.
All right, and then follow up, who is paying for the cost of these now? Is it the individual himself, and does this include people that like deliver potato chips to the school and everything, or who's included in this?
Representative Faust, we're hoping that we're not delivering potato chips, and that vegetables might be the appropriate. Representative Zettmer.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Faust, no, these are people that are having contact with kids, in the classroom or on field trips. These are, the people that are volunteering their time many times with sports events where they might be spending time alone with kids. So
principals. These are the types of volunteers. And right now, under current statute, they pay for their own background checks.
And Representative Demmer, I'm noting that the scope, however, and I do understand it's permissive, but there is a the scope is actually broader. That you know, prospective employees and coaches would also
correct.
Be within the scope of this permissive authority. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Again, the key word is may. We're not mandating that the school districts pay for the background checks. There might be someone that they might be recruiting as a staff or as a coach, and they might want to be able to pay for that background check, but it's not required.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and first an observation. It's 1995 now. By the end of this session, it could be. Any possible number north of that. Actually, a question from Ms. Larson. In reviewing the legislation, and this isn't directly to Representative Detmer's proposal here this morning, but do districts have statutory authority to require criminal background checks on people who utilize school grounds but do not have contact with students?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, under the law, in paragraph C in that first section, you'll see the kinds of individuals for whom the school hiring authority or the school may request a background check. It says any individual who seeks to enter a school or its grounds for the purpose of serving as a school volunteer or working as an independent contractor or student employee.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Larson, so if folks are utilizing the grounds but are not school volunteers, independent contractors, or student employees, does the district then have the statutory authority to require criminal background checks?
Ms. Larson.
Sorry.
That's a tough question for 9:10 in the morning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, if I can digress for a second,
please do.
A fellow I know who teaches at William Mitchell College of Law gives a course on statutory interpretation and asked for an example of a statute that would be problematic so that students could understand how difficult it was to interpret a statute, and I offered up this one.
I think it's actually a pretty direct answer.
I think it is. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a question maybe or just looking at those that are affected by this, I'm wondering if parents are volunteering to come in and do anything, are parents included, do they need a background check? Because often they'll come in and spend a little time helping with something, and if that's the case, I would like to at some point see that changed so that there's an exception made.
Mr. Chairman,
good luck,
and Mr. Chairman, and Representative Norris, in the conference committee, that was brought up, and we didn't feel that we need to cover that because many times parents come in and read the students. Teachers are there; the teachers are there supervising, and we didn't want to get that encompassing, making it that broad.
But not going there,
Representative Norris.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Well, and we can get into this pretty deep here, but so Representative Dabney, being myself ignorant of this section of law, I heard in your question that nonetheless some, and perhaps we'll get some testimony here actually, so that perhaps nonetheless there's some legal authority that exists somewhere that resides within district's authority to then establish and impose a standard of procedures and parameters around this decision of background check, independent of our state statutory language. I'm seeing Ms. Larson nodding her head.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, in my opinion, there would be nothing to foreclose the ability
yes.
or preclude the district from taking the initiative to ask for a background check as a condition of allowing someone to enter a school or its grounds. School officials do have the ability to control access in the interest of maintaining the integrity of the educational environment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Ms. Larson, again, even in situations where the individual does not have contact with the student, because I hear you're talking about maintaining the integrity of the educational environment, but does that extend to situations where there's no contact with the students or interference with the operations of the school? I'm sorry, I'll stop now.
No, Ms.
Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, having contact with students is a very difficult parameter to establish because it's impossible to say with absolute certainty that a single activity would, in every case, foreclose any contact with a student. It's just simply to say, well, if you're an independent contractor and your only job is to plow the driveway and you'll be in the plow, what's to say that you don't go into the school to warm up, for example? So putting those parameters around who has contact or who has exclusive contact with children has been very problematic in the context of this law.
And Ms. Larson, I'm intrigued by the notion that depending on how we define contact, you know, so perhaps you're talking about transferable communicable diseases, flu season. You know, there's some very creative possibilities here. I was reminded by our staff that we're debating current law, but of course it is important for us to understand current law as we make the decision that we're being asked to make. I believe we do have testimony, and I'll ask anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill before us, to come forward. Ms. Schwab, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Great to have her. I represent the Minnesota School Board Association. It's okay.
You did that
too.
I'm
still getting
yes,
used to my new name,
yes.
too. Pleasure to be with you here this morning. We have spoken ever so briefly with Representative Detmer on our concerns on this bill. If you look at that subdivision one, we believe this would encompass all employees at the school district, not just volunteers. And really it is the section C of this bill that addresses the volunteer piece. So this is, if you want to do just the volunteers, then it would be the section C. We have concerns about doing everyone. When this law became into effect, MSBA worked with the different organizations and came forward with this as the way to deal with the situation going forward. So this would be a big change and an additional mandate for school districts to deal with.
And Ms. Kelleher, is the association not convinced or applauded by Representative Detmer's permissive language in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, oftentimes we find clear statutory law is a good thing. We feel that this could become something we collectively bargain if it was changed for me.
Fair enough. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just coming from the school board, we do background checks on all employees as it is now. And this isn't requiring an additional background check. This is just for people that come new on the scene or a parent that might take kids on a field trip, but it's not requiring that current employees have another background check.
Ms. Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Newton, that first subdivision is really where we do the original background check, you know, as a school board member. This would make this that the employee could pay for it, or the district could pay for it. So that would impact how we presently do business. Section C deals with the volunteers, the people who come in and volunteer in the school district and the background check. So the scope here is very large. We're suggesting if you're looking to do volunteers, you add that language to Section C and not to the entire bill.
And member staff is pointing out that, in fact, the first section is a little bit broader. It does apply to coaching services. So there's a broader, I mean, so there, you know, if the desire is to sort of disentangle these, this might not be as easily disentangleable, if that's a verb, as possible. Representative Bettner.
Yeah, what I tried to point out, Mr. Chairman, what I tried to point out was that any new people coming in applying for jobs, they're not part of the bargaining unit. So, but it would allow the school board to, if they wanted to, pay for a background check on any new person coming in for employment. But that would not, this would not mandate them to do that. And they're not part of the existing bargaining unit that would be bargaining for this type of thing. And as the representative pointed out, that existing people that are employment, they've already had their background checks, and this does not require additional background checks. But I'm open. I'm open, Mr. Chairman. So,
any further discussion from members or anyone else in the public? Ms. Kelleher, you heard Representative Bettner's last statement. Assuming this bill moves forward, I would just simply urge you Representative Bettner to revisit this particular question, and it sounds like the author is willing to have that discussion. Thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question or a clarification, and perhaps either Ms. Larson or Representative Detmer could respond. What is the common practice among school districts currently? Are they paying for the background, or are the individuals paying for their own, or is it commonly part of the collective bargaining agreement? How is it generally handled?
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loon, I can speak for the district that I taught in for 34 years. The new incoming people that are applying for full-time employment, you know, they pay for their own background checks. Now, maybe the superintendent or the school board might work something out with certain people that come in for employment. But for all volunteers, in fact, one of my school districts, they already had their policy in effect before this came out last year. And their policy is that they will pay for all background checks on volunteers. So that's the current. And they called me and said, "Well, we're not in. They aren't abiding by the law. The new statute is that all people have to pay for their own background checks according to the current statute." So that's why I brought this forward.
Thank you. Important clarification that the law is. Quite direct and prescriptive about requiring individuals to pay for those background checks. Any further discussion? Members, if not, then the chair renews his motion that House File 320 be recommended to pass, referred to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bettner, and don't be a stranger.
No.
Members, we now have two bills from Representative Norton, House File 194 and House File 195. They are very similar. Representative Norton, I'll leave it to you in terms of what order we should actually attempt to move. I don't think we can have two before us officially for discussion, but obviously the discussion of one will pretty much entail the discussion of the other, and perhaps the bill that involves the temporary might actually be the better bill, because that captures that concept of temporary in terms of just laying it before itself.
Mm-hmm. So 195, Mr. Chair?
I think so, and then I believe it is your desire to move both bills, but I'm just wanting to make sure there's a bill before us where we can talk about all the parameters before us and captured by these two bills. So, Representative Norton, do you wish to move House File 195?
Yes, sir, I do.
Very well. Representative Norton moves House File 195 be recommended to pass, and I believe we're going to refer this to Finance Committee, and that's with a further recommendation that bill be re-referred to K-12 Finance. I hope I get it right. If not, we'll correct it. Representative Norton, your bill is properly before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am passing out the amendment that we discussed as well. And we can add that later if you'd like me just to start out.
Representative Norton, we can do that at this time. That's quite all right. And this was simply members. What we're doing is putting the bill in the form that the author wishes to have the bill considered before us. So there isn't typically, I mean, traditionally there isn't, you know, for newer members, we can certainly debate this particular amendment. We will debate it, the provisions within the broad bill, but it's kind of a courtesy for the authors to have a bill before us in the form that they wish to have it, and then we can debate it, and if it is the desire of the committee to even remove that section, we can then entertain motions to remove it. So Representative Norton moves that the A090015 amendment be moved onto House File 195. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is now before us in the form that you wish it to be, Representative Norton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And as 195 and 194, which we'll hear subsequently, are very similar, my comments are going to reflect my opinion on, or my thoughts on both bills, so I won't repeat myself. The one before you, House File 195, Mr. Chair, members, is a moratorium, if you will, on the Labor Day school start for the years 2009-2010 and 2010-2011. We've already heard terrific testimony from the superintendent of the St. Paul Public Schools, who was here this past Tuesday, and at that time I was tempted to call for the vote after she finished speaking, but I was afraid the chair might think I was out of order, so I didn't do that. But she did make some wonderful points, and hopefully our testifiers today will also address those same issues for you. For many years, as a parent and a school board member, we lamented the lack of local control concerning the start of the school year. In our district, we have meet and confer school start calendar committee every year or every other year. I get to serve on that as a parent and then also as board chair for several years, and we are forever fighting with setting the calendar so that we can fit everything in when we need to, and the start of school is very problematic in that. This next year, we're faced with an additional challenge in the next coming years when the Labor Day holiday falls later than normal, and I believe the dates are September 7th for this coming year, September 6th the following year, 5th, and then it jumps back to the 7th. So we're coming up upon several years where it will force the start of school to be September 8th or September 7th, which means, at least in my district, and I assume for many of you here, that that will mean mid-June graduations and mid-June last day of school end date. You'll hear a myriad of reasons for the needs of this bill from the testifiers that will come forward. I'm just going to give you my top three. My first one being local control. This is not a mandate of start time. In fact, it's going to allow districts to choose what time they start. So we're not mandating a later start time with this bill. We're just saying it's up to the local school districts to make the decision based on what's best for their children, their staff, and their community. And that could vary from year to year. The second is, my second reason is that it's a better match with extracurricular schedules, which already limit many families' ability to travel due to activities such as band and fall sports, which start in early to mid-August and subsequently through September. According to the Minnesota State High School League, over 88,000 senior high school students and some junior high school students participate in fall sports. So this is already affecting the times of the start of school are already affecting many, many of our families. And then my third reason is that this fits nicely, I think, with many of our intent to repeal unnecessary mandates. There are only three states, we're one of three, that have post-Labor Day start times. Michigan and Virginia are the other two. Another nine states do have mandatory start times that are as varied as August 19th all the way up to September 1st. And I'm sure they each have very unique reasons for choosing the dates that they do. But they are all before ours. I think with that, I'm just going to reiterate what the superintendent of the St. Paul Public Schools said, which is this is really will give local school districts more opportunity to deal with what's best for their students and their ability to meet the student needs and student achievement issues that they have in their district. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I think I would like to provide the opportunity for our testifiers to present, if you have no objection.
Representative Norton, perhaps you can just very quickly, I know it's a very simple bill, but if you can just very quickly walk through it and particularly speak to the amendment.
The amendment, I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned, it does have a moratorium on school start date for the first 2 years, and thank you for that. I forgot about the amendment. What the amendment does is ask the Commissioner of Education to contract, as it says, with an independent firm to study the economic impact on resorts, and so the resort industry, and then come back to this legislature at the end of those 2 years and report. What this also does is say that pending the legislature's making a decision at the end of hearing the result of that report, that it will repeal it. The original bill will be repealed, not this one. The original legislation would be repealed. So the legislature would have to take act at the end of the 2 years based on the information they heard, if they felt there was indication of any economic impact that was due to the school start time as opposed to just our current economic time.
And Representative Norton and perhaps Ms. Larson, I'll give you a heads up here. I just want to make sure I understand how the amendment would work. I understand that the amendment calls for a study. I think it's a good idea, frankly. I mean, we've battled over this bill over the years, and we hear all sorts of thoughts from people on all sides of the issue on what the impact is on students, families, but also what the impact is on our tourism industry. But in fact, I've not seen quantifiable data that connects student enrollment at any time of the year tied to that industry. I mean, I think there is some intuitive common sense issues perhaps there, but I've not seen any data that quantifies that one way or the other, that impact. But then you have the repeal of the existing, I believe, if I'm reading it right, the repeal of the existing language. And the repeal is not, as I read, is not subject to the report. It's just a flat-out appeal once the report. And mm-hmm. as far as I'm seeing you nod your head, mm-hmm. I'm reading that right. Okay. Very well. Ms.
Larson. Mr. Chairman, members, I think this question has come up from several members of this committee. And just to clarify, in Section 3 that appears on the amendment, there is an effective date. Our practice of late has been to apply effective dates by the section. And my understanding from looking at this amendment is that the effective date that appears at the bottom of page 1 applies to Section 3, the repealer, and the effective date language says this section as opposed to this act. So my assumption is that the intent is that the effective date applies only to Section 3.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I was going to just share a little bit of information because you did ask about the link, and this isn't a direct link, but there was some information that Minnesota School Board Association had sent to me from the Minnesota Hospitality Association, which says The number of resorts in Minnesota has dropped from 2,527 in 1970, which is about the time this bill was originally enacted, to fewer than 900 resorts open for business in 2007, a 65% drop, and that's with the school start date in place. So there obviously the school start date has not had any impact on that 65% drop. That was the closest to any data that I had on that for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Very well. Members, we do have several individuals and organizations that wish to testify for and against the bill. I'm counting one, two people, five, six, seven, eight, I think, kind of about a dozen. We're not going to be able to have a dozen people come and spend even 5 minutes each to do that because we're simply going to run out of time. And so with my early apology to the testifiers, I'm going to ask that we limit testimony pro and con to 10 minutes for each side. That'll give us 20 minutes, which then will give us a little under 10 minutes for then the committee to do any further deliberation and make its motions. We still have another bill before us, although it's the same issue, and but we need some time to be able to process that as well. So I ask for your forgiveness, but also for your understanding in that regard. So with that, I'm going to call forward Mr. John Curry. John, and I'm going to ask you to come up in groups, if that's okay. John Langard, Kurt Schneiderwin, and Jan Alswager. My understanding is that these would be testifiers pro the Norton bill or bills. And so perhaps we could take them in that order. John Curry, Superintendent of Rosemont Apple Valley. Good morning, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and of course, obviously, we're looking for very concise testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Curry, Superintendent of Schools, Rosemont Apple Valley Egan School District Number 196. I also serve on the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators and on the Legislative Committee of AMSD. And I'm here to speak in favor of allowing local school boards to make this decision. I come at that from several experiences and evidence from my standpoint. We have a school calendar committee that constructs a calendar for 2 years at a time. As part of that, last fall, we did a survey. We also had 35 site council meetings across each of our sites, not only about that, but the bottom line was on the survey, for example, we asked the question, do you approve of state legislation that would allow school boards to determine the school start date in their own district? Our citizens responded that 73% in favor, 16% no. We went on to ask them, do you prefer a before Labor Day start with an early dismissal in June or a late after Labor Day start and a later dismissal? And they favor that by over a 2-to-1 margin. This is an important issue for us. We view it as a local control issue. We believe it rests in the local school board's hands. Three times in the last 14 years, for example, the legislature has allowed us to start school before Labor Day, and that's especially when Labor Day is as late as it is. In terms of our citizens being in town the week before Labor Day, over half of our students are involved in co-curricular or other activities at high schools. Add to it the middle school roundups and open houses and elementaries. The number of our families that are in our community the week before Labor Day is extremely high already. Our board has approved two calendars for each year, and we've said to our community, one starts before Labor Day on the Monday before Labor Day. The other one starts after Labor Day. It changes by a full week, our dismissal in June, and we've said to our community we will wait. We're hoping that the legislature decides this early so that our citizens can start to plan, and that our school board then is waiting to see if you do, in fact, approve a plan. And then finally, in the past, the legislature has allowed a start day of September 1st. We would ask that, if permitted, August 31st would be better. If we don't get a full weekend before Labor Day, that pushes our calendar another week into June. So again, we see it as a local control issue, and our suggestion would be to allow local school boards to make this decision easier. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Where's my list here? Okay, and I take it this is you are John Langard? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak a few moments. I'm John Langard, Superintendent of the Worthington School District, which is in the southwest corner of Minnesota.
My goodness, Superintendent, did you drive up here this morning?
I did, 4 o'clock this morning.
You are a brave and dutiful citizen. Welcome for making that. I honor that you made that trip to us.
And I feel very passionate about the fact that our district is very much in support of the repeal of the Start Day legislation. From the standpoint, our makeup in our district is 50% minority. In our elementary, it's 60% this year.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a unique makeup, and we actually are in the process of conducting a survey of our parents, primarily the elementary. We can hit 50% of our student population by doing that in about half of our households. In that survey, the rough data, of which all of it's not due back in until Monday for our work session with our school board, but 57% of our parents are saying they favor the start before the Labor Day. And the feedback that we are preliminarily getting is the fact that they're more concerned about going past Memorial Day than starting before Labor Day, which in greater Minnesota, that, in my past history of being around the state, whether northwest Minnesota or in the seven counties, seems to be a larger issue for the rural districts than maybe even the metro districts. I appreciate Dr. Curry's approach to this, and I agree with his point. We need to have that flexibility, and it should be the school district's decision. Our local community is going to tell us if we're starting too early, and I think they are very vocal on that issue in itself. Some of the things that we have, we've been meeting as a 12-group superintendent group trying to develop a common calendar that we can utilize to share services, and whether it be staff, whether it be staff development days, a collaborative effort, and we would like to encourage you, or I would like to encourage you, to make that decision early on so that we can get appropriate planning time. In our district, we put 2 calendar years out to the community and our staff ahead of time. So we'll be doing not only for next year, but the year after when we're doing these calendars. We also will be approving 2 calendars for the upcoming year, the before Labor Day and after Labor Day start. But I think it's imperative from our standpoint. We have that flexibility, and it's based on our community's expectations for a start date. We see that as potential academic gains for our population. We feel it allows better flexibility, and we would probably do some things different compared to Dr. Curry's approach in the calendars, but I think that's unique to our school system. It's unique to our location in the state. When the weather prevails on us, and when I was up in northwest Minnesota, we went to school when it was 30 below. I can't do that in southwest Minnesota because the expectations are different. So I think each of us in the district or in the state all have unique approaches of how we address our calendars.
Thank you, Superintendent Langard, and thank you again for making a long journey here. It sounds like you have one final point here.
I do, and one of the things that comes up is the state fair. You know, we have 4-H participants that go to the state fair. We allow those students as part of it's right in our handbook, to go to those type of events, whether it's a family function or participation in the state fair as an educational opportunity. So I think that's important that you know that, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's good to know, and it is indeed a good opportunity for young people to participate actively in the fair. Thank you. And thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Schneiderlin and Ms. Auslager, we are pushing the clock here, and I want to make sure we have some time for our testifiers on the other side of the issue as well. So,
thank
good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Kirk Schneiderlin. I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And as you know, we have came out with a list of 100 mandates that were requested by you. And this is probably one of the top non-economic issues that our school board members want to see changed this year, without question. And you can see if you're a new board member elected in November and come on the board in January and you're already confronted with calendar questions and you're limited by the start date already, you're starting to question what authority you do have as a school board member. So I think it's really important that we allow those school boards who are right there on street level working with communities, working with organizations within the community to have that decision. And I've already had this debate in my own household at home about this and being frustrated with the potential late start in September. And I know that school districts and school boards take this seriously and welcome that engagement and discussion with the community because they're kind of the center part of the community, and it would not be a good stroke to dismiss that and make that decision by itself. And I think it's important for you to know that this, if you ask any superintendent whether they would prefer to have learning opportunities in late August, early September versus middle to late June, they want those learning opportunities at the beginning of the year. And I just think that this makes sense, and I just want to emphasize this does not require every district to start after Labor Day. They have that choice. They can engage their community, and if you have a strong 4-H piece in your community, and those folks come forward and have that discussion at the local level, then that needs to be a part of the decision-making when they go into the calendar. So those, as well as the fact, the local control issue, as well as options for improving student achievement are strong pieces that need to be considered. And I think that the superintendents have done a great job of sharing with you what they have done at the local level, and we support Representative Norton's effort here to make sure that that effort is restored to local school boards and their communities.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Ms. Altplug, I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Senator. Ms. Altplug.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Altplugger, Education Minnesota. I think that the previous testifiers have done a great job in the interest of time. I will just go on record saying that Education Minnesota supports the repeal of the Labor Day start for the issues of local control and meeting the needs of the local community, and also along with the lines of student achievement. So I'll leave it at that and be very brief. Not always what I just asked.
Thank you, Ms. Altschlager. Very well done. You're a model. All right. If I can now ask Mr. Paul Bugbee, Mr. Joel Carlson, Mr. Ed Becker, and Mr. Joel Magnoli, Mr. Kurt Schultz and Mr. John Edmond, and because this group is large, I am going to ask you to be very concise. Please do not take that as a sign of disinterest or disrespect on the part of the chair. It's more a logistical issue with us. So welcome to the committee this morning.
Well,
and you are Paul Bugbee? No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We can go whatever order you want. Just state your name for the record so I know who we're addressing. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, and it's a pleasure to once again be in front of you on the post-Labor Day school start issue. My daughter was a page here last year, and we were talking about my day last night, and I said, well, I got to go on the post-Labor Day issue again, and she's like, Dad, come on, man. You've been working on that since I was in kindergarten. She's a senior in high school now, and she says, is this like an issue Mark Olson is working on? And I said, no, honey, it just feels that way. But we want you to know and be very clear on behalf of the resorting community and the Congress that we support quality education as a top priority for the state of Minnesota. And we do not want you to pit tourism economics or resort economics against quality learning outcomes. But as we've studied this issue over the long number of years, and it probably doesn't go back to the 70s, but I was in the legislature in 1985 and 86, and I know it was an issue then. It was first adopted in 1986 that I'm aware of. And, we have come to the conclusion that there is nothing to suggest that starting school before Labor Day has any impact on quality learning outcomes. And of all the competing interests you have, all the issues that you can look at that improve learning outcomes, all day K, longer time on task during the day, They're just a better use of the school calendar during the school year. We just think that there are a number of things that you can consider as you balance these competing interests. And we appreciate your time, and there are a lot of us to testify. I received that quality education here in Minnesota, and I can count pretty well. And so I just want you to know that as this progresses through the process, I want you to know that there are a number of interests involved. And when Rep. M. Norton talks about the decline of resorts, you need to understand you can study it all you want, but once a resort leaves in Minnesota, it never returns. Once that property is converted to private use, it never comes back. There isn't a resort that starts up in Minnesota. The pressure on lakeshore property is severe, and it is impossible for anyone to start a new resort. You can study it after the fact, but that will not have any impact on whether or not resorts continue to decline, because it just is not, that is not the trend. And the number is closer to 3,500 resorts that we enjoyed in the early 70s in Minnesota. We're down to about 800. We lose four or five a month. And that is your constituents' access to our great resources that we have in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And I would welcome, assuming that this issue continues throughout the session, that I would welcome any quantifiable data about connecting both student access to seasonal recreational well-being, as well as Minnesota families' connection. And I mean that sincerely. I would like to, if there is quantifiable data, I would like to be able to see that. Perhaps you can help us with that.
And, Mr. Chairman, there's a website that we just stumbled onto called Save Our Summers. It's trying to do that quantifiable research across the country, and it's a family time issue and a quality time issue with families that they're focused on. So there is some data that's out there, and we'll try and get that to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Members, we have about 10 minutes left, so we are going to have to move rather quickly, and whoever's next, please just state your name for the record and proceed.
I think in the interest of time, I'll go next, and I will be quick because most of what I was going to talk about is stuff that Joel covered already.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Becker, and I'm from Nevis, Minnesota. I did also travel a great distance to get here.
And I honor your willingness to do that, Mr. Becker.
Thank you. I'm here also on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. I am currently acting as a legislative chair, and we work on some of these legislative issues as well. And I own a resort up there by Nevis, Minnesota. It's Inwego Resort. It's on the Crow Wing Channel Lakes, and we're on the 8th Crow Wing. Again, just to reiterate, by coming here and testifying what appears to be on the opposite side of the aisle as the folks from what we just had them talking to, I am very pro-education. I sit on our current school board, and I spend more hours than I care to admit on educating our youth in Minnesota. As a school board member, and all these folks know as well as I do, there's hundreds and hundreds of pages of policies and mandates already. And I would just encourage you to consider all the interests of the state and not just the interests of education in this particular case. In order for us to put money into the general fund, I've got statistics, but I don't want to go into it as far as, you know, what each week of the summer provides to the general fund for dollars for everybody to grab. I would just also, I promise to be brief, so I'm going to go ahead and finish up here. Our school district does start after Labor Day, and we are out before Memorial Day. If you look at the statistics, there's a website, and I apologize for not having it. My superintendent looked it up for me. The average number of contact days is 172. Some school districts have 167. Some have 174, with 180 mandated contract days for the teachers. We have 172 days. We start after Labor Day. We're out Memorial Day. It is possible to do within the current calendar year, and it does allow some flexibility, a couple of snow days, all the holidays.
That being said,
I apologize.
I'll be as short as I can be.
Yeah, I'm going to mute the rush real long.
Thank you.
I do apologize for that, but thank you.
Yeah.
So, and welcome. Good morning, sir.
Thanks. I'm Paul Buckbean. Joel Carlson is a better looking guy than I am, so he's
well, we could put that to a vote, Mr. Buckbean.
I have a prepared statement. I've edited it down here, and I'll try to run through it quite quickly.
Please do.
I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association, and it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me. Over 95% of all resorts and campgrounds in Minnesota are still what they call ma-and-pa summer seasonal businesses. In spite of my efforts to expand our own business into a year-round business, 85% of our business still occurs in the 3 months of summer, June, July, and August. In a perfect world, this means that those of us in the summer resort and campground business have a window of 12 weeks in which to make our businesses successful. In reality, for most of us, we don't realize anything near a brisk business until the third week in June, with a rapid decline in occupancy during the last 2 weeks of August. 8 to 10 weeks is our peak season. Why is our season so short, you might ask? The obvious answer is simply the fact that we live in Minnesota, and the water's cold in June. Reduce my statement here. Another obvious reason is that the Minnesota school calendar, without question, defines our season. We are family resorts, and families don't take family vacations in Minnesota while their schools are still in session. In fact, although the water temperatures and the summer sunshine are at their peak by the end of August, those of us in the resort and campground business experience a sharp decline in occupancy during the last 2 weeks of August because of the advent of school sports and activities. Resorting is a livelihood that we all love and enjoy, but at the end of the day, it is still a business. However, with the upward spike in lakeshore property values and corresponding property taxes, the ever-increasing shoreland zoning regulations, the seasonal nature of our businesses, and the fact that Ma and Pa aren't getting any younger, there's little wonder why so many resort and campground properties in Minnesota are being sold for private residential development. Statistically, we are experiencing an 8 to 10% attrition rate in Minnesota resorts annually. The great Minnesota family resorting tradition is going, going, going. And here we are at the Minnesota State Legislature again. Here we are again fighting the annual battle regarding the Labor Day school start in Minnesota. And why, and I'll make this brief, we appreciate the fact that the Minnesota legislature nearly 25 years ago passed the Labor Day school start. We recognize that Minnesota didn't need to do this. We recognize and respect the desire for autonomy and independence within each of our school districts, and we are appreciative for that. And we appreciate that the state has adjusted their school calendars to conform to the post-Labor Day school start. Their acceptance and adherence to this legislation has allowed most of us in the resorting and campground business to stay in business. Effectively, it has meant one more week of business for us in a very short season. Although we may not presently fill our cottages and campgrounds with guests that last week of August, the post-Labor Day school bill allows us to at least fill the second week of August. Again, considering that most school sports and activity programs are in full swing 2 weeks prior to the start of school. In spite of the annual introduction of bills to repeal or modify the post-Labor Day school start, the resort industry continues to fight this battle because of its incredible significance to our business. Repealing this legislation, even for a year or two, will surely have a negative impact on our tourism business with an 8 to 15% loss in revenues annually. For many, it will be the final nail in their coffin. Next week, I hope to meet with the Minnesota School Board Association representatives and ask them, why is this such a big issue? I appreciate their comments earlier. Almost done. According to our studies, most school districts within the state allow between 20 and 30 non-pupil days throughout the school year as it is, not counting those days off for major holidays. Is it the intent of an earlier school start to increase the number of non-pupil school days during the school year? And I'll cut this short.
Mr. Buckley, I am going to need to ask you to finish here.
Thank you for your consideration.
I appreciate your information, your well thought out and presented testimony.
Members, I do want to get us to a vote. We do have three other individuals. The chair is not going to take testimony further except to acknowledge your presence, and perhaps if you can just quickly state your name and let us know whether you're for or against the bill, we can at least have that in record. Trust me, if this bill gets out of this committee, it's going to be in at least two other committees, and there'll be, I suspect, ample opportunity there. So please, if you can just state your name for the record and let us know whether you're supportive or not supportive of the bill so we can have that on the record. And I do apologize for rushing you that way.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schultz. I'm with the Madison Hospitality Group out of Brainerd, Minnesota, and we are for against this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chair, Joe Bagnoli with McGran Shea Law Firm representing the Minnesota Agricultural Society, better known as the State Fair. We would also oppose this bill, and we are for education.
Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli.
And Mr. Chairman, my name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. My only point is that we represent the entire tourism industry. This issue affects everyone beyond resorts. It's an $11 billion industry, and we'd be looking to work with you on outcomes for education that's compatible with our industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edmond, and I would look forward to continuing to do that. Representative Norton, are we ready to, are you ready for us to vote on your bill?
I am. If I could just also state the supporters are Minnesota School Boards, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota Rural Education Association, Association of Metropolitan School Districts, Minnesota Business Partnership, others including St. Paul Regional Labor Federation, AFL-CIO.
Thank you. Representative Norton, reduce her motion that House File 195, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Representative Norton moves House File 194 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Workforce Development, I don't have the full name of the committee.
Higher Education and Workforce Development.
Very well. And Representative Norton, that bill is a much more simpler bill.
It is a simple repeal.
Okay. So members, that's before you. Discussion. Representative Riley.
Well, Mr. Chair, that was the one I thought I had just heard you say when I came up there that we were sending it to K-12 Finance. Wasn't that the wish of Representative Norton?
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, the bill that we just voted on was a two-year moratorium with a study and a repeal at the end of that. And that will go to you because of the study, which is the Department of Education.
All right. Thank you.
Sorry. Further discussion, clarification, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that I also authored a straight-up repeal bill and have a number of co-signers as well, so to give evidence of my support for this bill and recommend passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Downey. And members, the chair of the Workforce Development Committee, I think it's the longer Higher Education Workforce Development, has asked to see the bills. The way this will work, members, is that these bills will go to this hub, you know, the Finance Committee, and at that point, chairs who feel that they need to see any particular bill certainly have the option to pull those bills in. And recognition of Representative Rukavina's desire to see this issue, we're going to recommend that Finance honor that in regards to this bill. Quite frankly, I'll be very frank, we're wanting to make sure that this note should not wind up in a dead end without further deliberation. And so, ergo, the first bill has a strong recommendation to K-12 Finance review that bill. That still does not preclude any other chair to then pull that bill at that point. But we're wanting to make sure we have full discussion of this issue. And as you see, we've run out of time just in this committee. And so that's the mastermind design here, just to be very clear for everyone. So members, Representative Norton renews her motion to House File 194 be recommended to pass, referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee. I think I've got that right. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Norton. Thank you, members. We'll see you all next week. This committee is adjourned.